This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Unseelie King by Heather Kilo Walden, narrated by Anthony Ferguson. In light of every thought, every wish, every dream that keeps us sane, in the madness of this reality that makes us seek the other, the different, the better, the magic, so we don't lose our ever-loving minds. Chess is infinite, and one has to make only one ill-considered move, and one's opponent's wildest dreams will become reality. David Bronstein. Prologue. A little like a glass soda bottle exploding. Someday, in her distant future, Minerva might liken this feeling to that. To being shaken up her entire life, to feeling the pressure build and build, painful and stretching and so full, but keeping that lid on tight minute after minute, day after day, year after year, until finally, in some blessed and horrible and all-consuming out-of-control moment, something grabbed her bottle of a body and soul and slammed it once and for all against a countertop. She entered the bedroom and felt the death that was there, even before her feet crossed the threshold. She paused in the entryway, her deep, midnight gaze sliding over the resting forms of her adoptive parents with grounded clarity. There was no doubt about what she was seeing. She never once wondered whether she might be dreaming. She'd grown her whole life in the non-illusion that existence was pain. That truth was so very wrong. That life, in and of itself, depended upon death. Nothing could survive without killing something else. It was the way of a messed-up world. So when she saw her parents dead, their lifeless hands clasped between them on that mattress in a final bucking of fate that allowed them to at least slip away together, she knew it was real. And she turned around, left the room, left the house, and felt the most wondrous of changes break over her. Minerva stood on the front doorstep and raised her arms at her sides. There was a strength inside her, fueled by the hatred of 36 years of trumping agony. It was a tornado, whirling through her, scooping up magic that only moments ago she hadn't been certain existed. And then Minerva was dropping back her head and closing her eyes. Somewhere in the near distance, cars whizzed by, horns honked, and people walked in a packed crowd down an oblivious street. But up above, clouds were gathering, deep and dark and unnatural. A wind was building, a feeble attempt by nature at balancing out the normalcy of cruel, everyday life with what was about to be released into it by one little girl on the top step of a little house in a rural neighborhood, right on the cusp of a busy little tourist trap city.
"Don't do it, Minerva."
A voice sliced through the whirlwind, spiked through Minerva's drifting concentration, and slammed her focus right back into her brain, where it did not want to be. Minerva opened her eyes and looked down. At the base of the stairs stood a man. He was beautiful. And at once Minerva knew exactly who and what he was. It was a knowledge infusion that came immediately and uninvited. It was because of who she was, who she finally realized she was, and what she finally realized she could do. She knew so much in that moment, it was impossible. But it had happened anyway. So she knew who he was, the beautiful man with the amethyst eyes and the raven black hair who stood tall and imposing at the base of the stairs. She knew what he was, dressed in his perfectly tailored suit, his hands in his pockets, his gaze piercing, wrapped in darkness. He was wickedness incarnate. He was all of the magic and release and wonder and otherness that she had craved her entire fucking life, but that had always been just out of reach, leaving her lurching and yearning in this terrible reality she so desperately desired to escape. He was her dream lover, her mystery mate, The face and body she placed into every lead character of every romance novel she had ever read in her attempt to leave this world. And there he was, now, when she wanted him least of all. There he was, staring up at her, when it was too damn late, when all he could possibly do any longer was interrupt her, try to stop her, and keep her from getting the revenge she was due. "Why shouldn't I?" she asked. "What is there to save, and why the hell would you care, unholy king?" The man's chin raised, and his beautiful, piercing gaze narrowed thoughtfully. She knew then, as she knew everything else, that he was realizing what he was up against. She knew he was feeling her wrath, and he was unsure whether he was going to win this battle, or even leave this doorstep alive. "Because you care, Minerva, more than anyone else on the planet. You don't want to hurt anyone." He opened his hands beseechingly, and Minerva's gaze moved to his shiny black shoes, because she just knew he was going to try to take a step toward her. If he did, she was going to lay into him like a nightmare. "You hate the violence that dominates this world," he continued. "The last thing you want to do is add to it." He spoke to her in the calmest, gentlest of tones, like a frightened man to a ticking time bomb. He placed his hands on the metal railing of the back steps, and Minerva smiled. It was a detached gesture, one she barely felt, and one that seemed slightly alien to her. "You're right, and you're wrong," she told him calmly. "I do care. I always have." She shook her head. "Far too much." She paused for effect. "And so I want to hurt everyone," she hissed the word through a grin. "Starting with you." She was aware that the ring on his finger protected him from the iron in this world. Every Fae knew that, therefore now she did too. It was part of the incredible, impossible knowledge that had come slamming into her the moment she'd grown aware of who and what she was. The moment the pain inside of her had become unbalanced and too great compared to the pain outside of her. The ring gave him strength. So that was what she went for first. She looked at his hand, and her gaze narrowed. "I wish your ring didn't protect you any more." The beautiful man's unworldly eyes widened almost imperceptibly. He hadn't been expecting that. He hadn't expected her to know quite as much as she did, especially about him. But she was proving him wrong. The man's hands on the railing began to smoke. His brow furrowed and he looked down. His movements were slow, as if he were literally stunned by what he was experiencing. No doubt he was. And then, quite suddenly, he was yanking his hands away. At the same time, he began speaking arcane words in a voice that seemed as alien to this world as was the smile on Minerva's face. He was casting a spell at her. Minerva's already galactic anger spiked even more. She exploded into the world around her like so much soda spray and shards of glass. The bottle had at last been shattered. Everything was free now, and for once, for one blessed, well-deserved moment, she truly didn't care. The night was all silent. It was a kind of silence the mortal world would never know. There was too much buzzing there, either from insects or now from technology, ever running, always on. But here, in this strange and foreign land, there was nothing to make noise but the fire.
"Moonbeams."
His voice was merely more than a whisper, a softly spoken word to break through the quiet like an intruder. There was no response from her but a slight fluttering of her long, thick eyelashes, as if the word had struck her and she were flinching. She was pretending not to pay attention to what he was saying. But he knew she was hearing him loud and clear. He also knew that she was not only seething, but scheming behind her bonds and that calm, beautiful exterior.
"That's what my brother and I called the wishes when we were little," he continued.
using a stick to stoke the fire. It sent rainbow-colored sparks rising into the night, which swallowed them up and turned them into rainbow-colored stars. The wishes were said to be made of them. He watched her carefully. Rays of moonlight, blue and bright. She couldn't respond to him, of course, so even if she'd had something to say to that, she kept it to herself. The gag spell he'd cast upon her made certain of that. No sound would emit from her mouth until he lifted it. Or she figured out a way to use her wisher powers around it. It wasn't an uncomfortable spell. He'd used much worse on others. In fact, he'd gone to some extent to see to her comfort. The material he'd tied tightly but carefully around her was fey silk. It was woven by danids, large pure white butterflies that spun the silk using inherent magic, creating it out of the petals of the flowers they landed upon. It was so soft to the touch, it was said to soothe whoever wore it. That same material adorned Miniver's wrists and ankles. It was a necessary measure, strictly so. Caliban's purple-green eyes shot through like a double-colored tourmaline, shifted from the woman across from him to the space of land outside the shield he'd erected over and around them. The field had once been filled with fey grasses and wildflowers, and a small stream had wound picturesquely through it, with banks of thick, six-leaved crystal clover. Now, however, the grass was burned. The wildflowers were dead, and the stream was dammed. Caliban's gemstone eyes turned cold and hard when he saw what was damming it. He shifted his gaze once more to Miniver. "Like the moon, the wishes could turn the very tides," he said softly, "with no more than a thought." Miniver's dark, dark gaze suddenly lifted from the fire she had been staring into and met his head-on. At once, Caliban realized his mistake. No more than a thought. She closed those large dark eyes of hers, and Caliban braced himself. Something was coming, and he had no idea how to prepare for it. There was no defense against a wisher. It was why most of their kind had been destroyed at birth eons ago. The fire he'd built for them suddenly flared, and then went out. Caliban took a slow, calming breath. He cleared his mind, preparing his magic to be used at a heartbeat's notice. The ground began to tremble beneath his boots. He stood up. His gaze skirted to the fire. Its logs shifted, cracked, and sparked. The space beneath them split apart, and at once the logs were gone, dropped into a black hole that was yawning open at the center of the clearing. Caliban waited no longer. He lifted his right hand and spoke a powerful enchantment. Miniver's eyes flew open. Their dark, dark blue had gone black, and a flickering blue flame had sparked a life at their centers, ominous and telling. He felt her will buffet against his, a nearly physical force as her mind hastily whispered the words to some foul and powerful wish. And then his spell forced itself past her defenses to strike hard and fast. Her head flew back, her long silver hair flying around her. She swayed for a moment, her blue fire eyes slipping shut once more, and then she slumped against the log behind her, unconscious. Caliban's chest felt strange, empty, yet full. His gaze trailed over the curve of her chin, the slim line of her throat, to the collarbone that peeked from beneath her hooded zip-up jacket. After a moment he realized his hands felt strange. He glanced down to find them trembling, and he curled them into fists. The ache in his chest spread outward, reminding him of the wounds he'd sustained. He grimaced, dropped to the boulder beside him, and pulled his shirt over his head, exposing broad shoulders, sculpted muscles, and half a dozen bleeding wounds that would leave a variety of scars upon flesh that had never so much as been marred, not in thousands of years. He gingerly touched one of these wounds, sucked air through gritted teeth, and vowed to replenish his strength as soon as possible. He could at least close the open injuries then. The scars would remain for much longer. He turned his hand over and looked at the ring on his middle finger. For millennia, it had protected him from the one element in the realms that could bring him more damage than any other. Iron. Now, however, it rested dull and useless upon his finger. Caliban sighed, pulled the worthless trinket off, and tossed it into the hole where the fire had once been. He would need a new one, and they were very hard to come by. Before he'd brought her here to the Twixt, this realm between realms, Miniver had faced off with him in the streets of Oxford, England. She'd been out of control, enraged by her parents' death, and glowing with more vengeful power than any magical creature could handle. She'd lashed out at him, instantly knowing who he was and what his weaknesses were. She'd glanced at his ring and made it inert with no more than a muttered wish. A single venomous phrase, hissed with fury, that had made him vulnerable to an attack he had not, in the least, been expecting. Then she'd thrown everything at him. Cars, street signs, barbed wire, you name it, and he'd never had to dodge or duck or speak his own magic so fast in his very long life. He'd barely managed to get her through his portal and out of human sight in time to prevent her from inadvertently murdering the lot of them. For the life of him, he couldn't believe he, himself, was still breathing. There had been moments over the course of the last few hours that he had been frightened she'd not only learned his weaknesses, but his very name. All she would have to do was speak it aloud just once, and she would have had absolute control over him. All would have been lost. It had been luck that saved them from that fate, there but for the luck of the Fae, and he'd never been more grateful for it. Now Caliban ran a tired hand through his jet-black hair and swallowed hard. His striking bicolored gaze once more left the confines of their shielded space to the small field that lay beyond. It was a tiny place in one of the many forests that bordered his lands and separated them from the realm of his brother. There, in that telling darkness, bodies littered the ground. The younger ones who had been playing games now hung scorched from the trees, their burned limbs tangled in the branches like ropes. Others had fallen across the creek, damming it up like burned logs. This was what happened when a wisher was threatened. This was what happened when a wisher of Miniver's magnitude lost control. His only consolation was that Miniver hadn't seen them die. She didn't even know they were there. Her magic had simply exploded into the surrounding land, taking out those who were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. While in their natural realm, the inhabitants of the Twixt were not visible to anyone but a citizen of the realm, Miniver would not be able to see them until she officially accepted her place as his queen. He had his work cut out for him, if that was ever going to happen. Chapter 1. The doors opened before him of their own accord. In the Unseelie Kingdom every soul recognized his, as an animal sensing an oncoming earthquake or the rumble of a mighty storm, ears perked and rock listened, and doors opened and made way. The sound of boots on stone echoed in the vast emptiness of the room beyond, sending shockwaves of preparation through the chamber's inhabitants. There was silence there, in those waiting eyes. Those rapid beating hearts, but there was music as well. If it had been audible to a mortal, it would have sounded foreboding, beautiful but deadly. It was a haunting melody that welcomed a haunted sovereign into a room of darkness. Against the far wall there was a door. It was a tall single door with a simple gold turning knob of the type found in nearly every door in the mortal realm. It was the only decoration of note in the large space, which was otherwise marble, smooth, and featureless. The room was devoid of furniture or windows. There was only the door before him, and the double doors behind him. But the double doors, despite their larger size, were so very dull and uninteresting compared to the single white door, which was as white as snow. From around the door's edges, light emitted,
outlining the opening with a tempting curiosity. What lay beyond it? Anyone would want to find out. It was beside this door that two men waited. One was dressed in finery of a style unknown in the mortal realm, hewn in the same dark tones as his approaching king. The other wore the same, but his sleeve had been torn, his collar blooded, and there were stains upon his knees. He was also in chains. There were four other men in the room, but these men were clearly soldiers, nearly featureless in their monochromatic synchronicity. They remained standing at the room's four corners, postures tall, shoulders back, eyes fixed on something no one could see. Caliban approached the two men beside the door.
"My liege,"
greeted the one holding the other by his cuffed wrists. It was a greeting, a question, and a show of fearful respect. Caliban said nothing as he closed the distance and stopped before them. He didn't have to say anything. The bound Fae was a Kored, a beautiful man with a black heart and a mind that had drifted unfortunately toward treason. He'd been caught leaking information about Caliban's borders to Shadow Fae spies. Shadow Fae, otherwise known as Shades, were the dark and sneaky inhabitants of the crossover land that was partly governed by the Unseely King and partly by his brother, the Seely King, Avery. The realm was generally known to Fae as the Twixt, and as it contained no real borders, its reaches were vast, possessing of a large variety of Fae species, from those aligned more with the Seely to those... not. But their allegiance was to neither. Shades lived in a portion of the Twixt that also bordered the Shadow Kingdom, much like regions or states of a country could border one another in the mortal realm. They were tainted both by this darkness and the different kind of darkness inherent in the Unseely realm. Shades wanted nothing more than to dissolve the borders and allow the Unseely Fae to roam freely into the Seely realm, where portals to the mortal world were more plentiful. The chaos that would then ensue amongst the mortals would keep both kings so busy the Shades would be free to slip away unnoticed, into the mortal realm and beyond, where they could become what their souls directed. Thieves, bounty hunters, assassins, and worse. And not a force in any mortal realm would be able to stop them, much less gather them all up again and imprison them in the borders they were currently kept to. Contrary to uneducated belief, all Fae had a dark side. Even those seemingly harmless creatures that roamed free in the Seely realm, even the fluffiest of them with large eyes and floppy ears and twitching tails, even those humans would endearingly term adorable, were more than what they seemed. But amongst the Fae, dark sides and all, some were undoubtedly darker than others. Most of those lived in Caliban's realm, and his hold upon them was tight-fisted and brutal. It had to be. Others lived in Daemon Croy's realm, where goblins resided, and where their king was forced to be as strict and unendingly vigilant as Caliban. The last lived in the in-between realms, such as the border between Caliban's realm and his brothers, trapped there because no king wished to guard them alone. That would be foolish. Shades did not reside there alone, of course. There were others, but the Shades were the most trouble. The others simply bided their time, knowing that one day one of the kings would slip up, and the plan the Shadow Fae continuously tried to set in motion would finally come to fruition, and they would all be free. Now, as Caliban approached the traitor who would have brought the Fae realms one step closer to that dismal fate, he prepared himself to do what needed to be done. It should have been easy. He'd been here before, hundreds of times, but regardless of his reputation and the nearly cruel lifespan of men like him, there were some things he would never get used to. He just had to make certain no one else knew that. Caliban eyed the white door for just a moment, the hair standing up at the back of his neck. Then he turned and stared the bound man in the eyes.
"Keoran,"
You've betrayed my realm, my people, and most importantly, myself. He said softly. I hope the reward was worth it.
The traitor swallowed audibly, but could not reply. Caliban knew good and well that there was nothing he could say. No matter what the Shades had promised him, nothing was worth what the Unseelie King was about to do. Nothing was worth this particular punishment. Which was why Caliban had to do it. The only way to rule over a nation such as his own was with an iron fist. Unseelie Fae were like hungry sharks in a sea devoid of fish. All it took was one whiff of blood, one show of weakness, and the feeding frenzy would begin. Caliban took a deep breath and decided to put an end to the terrible anticipation that filled the room. He lifted his head, nodded at the nearest guard, and the guard came forward to place his hand on the knob of the single white door. The prisoner, Keoran, straightened in his metal bindings, which were partly iron. Caliban could smell his skin scorching under the touch of that particular metal, which was caustic to nearly all Fae, Seelie and Unseelie alike. The only Fae, in fact, who had ever proved immune to its effects were the Wish Fae. Why, no one knew. A newly acquired ring on Caliban's finger protected him from the iron, should he touch it. He'd worn a ring like this for thousands of years, and had been fortunate that a replacement was available for the one Minerva had destroyed. Thus far, the young Wisher was the only creature alive who'd been capable of ridding him of it. Keoran turned to look at the white door and stiffened. The man holding him tightened his grip on the prisoner. Everyone but Caliban and the guard took a step back. Caliban gave the guard another nod, small and meaningful. The guard turned the knob and the door swung inward, opening with slow precision. Sunlight flooded the white room, filling it with the same glow that had outlined the white door. Caliban gazed into the landscape beyond, taking in the forbidden forest he'd only glimpsed a handful of times in his long existence. Motes of light captured airborne blossoms that cascaded from bloom-filled willow trees to carpet the thick green grass of the forest floor. A large stream ran clean and pure through a clearing, babbling invitingly as it tumbled over river rocks and pebbles. Mushrooms of rainbow hues gathered in bunches along the river's banks, along with plush, cushiony mosses. Butterflies flitted here and there, capturing sunlight that caused their wings to momentarily glow. Birds chirped, and a pleasantly fragrant breeze gently touched the petals of flowers bearing impossibly beautiful markings. The bound man turned to Caliban with new fear in his eyes. "Please," he said, and the single word felt as if it were bound to his soul. "Please," he repeated. "Show mercy." The king looked back down. The prisoner was sweating, moisture darkening his blonde locks and marring his otherwise perfect fey complexion. He was clearly not used to the show of weakness, and it was clearly all he had left.
"Kill me instead,"
he pled in a whisper. The room stilled, holding its collective breath. Caliban's lips turned up mirthlessly, and his piercing eyes hardened into beautiful stones.
"If you'd wanted mercy, Keoran, you should have chosen to live in my brother's realm."
He shook his head, just once.
"Unfortunately for you, you chose mine."
He turned away from the prisoner.
"See him in."
The forest beyond the white door was the most beautiful in the Fae realm, yet its beauty was balanced out with an equal measure of ugliness. The prisoner began to struggle. The heels of his boots attempted to find purchase as the guards edged him over the threshold of the door. The Unseelie King couldn't blame him for fighting. He'd never condemned anyone who hadn't fought, not when it came to this particular fate. The land beyond the door belonged to the most deceptive of creatures in the Fae realms. The unicorn.
"Please!"
the man bellowed frantically. He had no magic to use to aid him in escape. There was no recourse remaining. Caliban had seen to that.
I shared nothing. Nothing has been lost to you.
That much was true. Caliban had discovered the man's treachery before any real damage had been done. The Shades were denied their inside information, and Keoran was taken into custody. But second chances were not in Cal's repertoire.
Try to think happy thoughts, Caliban advised icily. Then, as the man was thrown violently into the land beyond, and its portal sliced open and shut with tight, imprisoning magic, the Unseelie King turned on his heel to make his way calmly to the double doors across the room. There were screams behind him that died into muffled agony as the white door was closed once more. No lock was necessary. No one would willingly enter the unicorn's forest. Once upon a distant time, unicorns had been different. They'd been worthy of the stories humans now told of them. But one day, a curse befell them. It was a curse among curses, and one laid upon them by no other than a wisher. Out of spite, out of jealousy, or perhaps some sudden fit of anger, no one would ever know. The wisher then died at the hands of the very creatures he had cursed, and everything changed. Unicorns became what they were today, and what they had been for thousands of years. The noble unicorn was a beautiful creature made of great magic, but contrary to popular human tales, they were not born as the majestic creatures featured on tapestries adorning mansions and castles in the mortal realm. They were in fact born with dull coats, mottled and mousy, and without horns. A unicorn's beauty came over time. It was the direct result of the maddening agony it inflicted upon its victims. Unicorns possessed the power to cause their victims to witness firsthand their very worst fears. This would be done over and over again, and little by little, the unicorn's coat would slowly transform into the pure white or black that mortals associated with it. Every tear a unicorn's victim shed was a diamond dust shimmer upon its coat, adding to its otherworldly beauty. And as its victim's torture crescendoed to a pain so vast it brought the victim death, the unicorn at last earned its horn. Over and over again, one unicorn after another matured in this grisly manner. The more innocent the victim, the worse its pain, for there was no jaded emotional armor to protect it. Women, children, all manner of fey and mortal fell before the cursed wrath of the unicorn. This was why Caliban and his brother had finally locked the creatures away in their own land, one off limits to all fey, and impossible to reach but through that single white door. Keoran would suffer his worst fears as if he were living them out, feeling every agonizing detail time and again, until he at last drew his final, merciful breath. Caliban had just aided in the final transformation of a unicorn. There was no more evil deed. As he left the judgment chamber and entered another portal that took him to the landing strip of a private black jet, he tried not to let his internal distress show. He knew he would succeed. He'd had eons to practice honing the cold expression on his handsome face and the icicles in his amethyst gaze. No one would ever suspect that he hated himself for what he'd done. No one would know that he once more questioned not only his decision, but his very existence. No one would have the faintest inkling that he was comparing himself to the Goblin King in that moment, thinking that even Daemon Croy could get a woman to love him in that godforsaken prison of a realm the Goblin King had been banished to thousands of years ago. But that there was no way in any living hell Miniver Tristane would come to accept Caliban's cruelty, much less love him in spite of it. A sudden pain across his chest lanced through his internal thoughts, and he looked down, absently placing his hand over his heart. The wounds Miniver had given him during their battle were refusing to heal. She'd located every item made of iron or its composite that she could, and thrown it at him. She'd tried her very best to kill him. The wounds were what the Fae would term ironborn, and it would take great strength to heal them. Even then they would scar. Caliban dropped his hand and approached his plane.
But despite his confident step and unreadable expression, hope bled out of him, along with every fresh drop of blood his iron-born wounds gave up. In that desperate, pain-filled moment, Caliban experienced very real doubt. There was no way he was going to win Miniver as his queen. Not on this chessboard. No way in hell. Chapter 2 Lalura Chantel turned the bag over, allowing the apples within it to topple into the waiting basket upon her table. Then she stilled. The centuries-old Simaruta pendant beneath her blouse pulsed warmly with warning. She placed her hand on it for a moment, her gaze refocusing upon the apples in the basket. A moment later, she reached into the basket, bypassing the apples on top for one in the middle. She pulled it out and turned it over in her hands. It was a seemingly perfect apple, round and crisp-looking, red-orange and unmarred. Lalura turned in her kitchen and made her way to the chopping block on the island at its center. There she placed the apple upon the wood, grabbed a large knife, and slammed the blade home with practiced precision and a strength unlikely for her apparently frail form. The knife sliced clean through the apple's center, and the two halves tipped away from the metal onto their sides, revealing the apple's interior. Lalura deftly placed the knife to the side, and narrowed her gaze. The apple that had been perfect on the outside, for all intents and purposes indistinguishable from the others, was in fact quite different where it mattered. Marring the otherwise pristine glistening white of its inner fruit was a large black hole. As Lalura watched, a small black worm wiggled from this grimy hole, extending itself as if to sniff the air for the source of its home's intrusion. Lalura picked up the bad apple and turned it slowly in her hand. There was a part of her, no matter how old or wizened, that could not believe what she was seeing, that did not wish to accept the truth of this revelation. Not here. Not them. Not amongst the 13. But she had lived a long time and learned a great many lessons. Not the least of those lessons was that things were not always as they seemed, no matter how much you may wish to believe otherwise. And, very unfortunately, fruit was not the only thing that could rot from the inside out. Lalura moved through the kitchen to the back door, where she opened it and tossed out the rotten apple that would have spoiled the bunch had she not revealed it for what it was and separated it from the others. Then, very softly, she sighed.
"There is a traitor among us."
"I know you're worried," he said softly, leaning across the table to capture her gaze well and firmly within his. "If I could turn back time..." He shook his head, taking a deep breath and expelling it with resignation. "But only the Time King can do that." He blinked. "Or could have at one point." He frowned and closed his eyes for a moment, as if forcing himself to return to the subject at hand. "But you must believe me when I tell you that your sister is with Cal right now, and the best thing we can do for her is to not go looking for her." Celine stared into those piercing, bicolored eyes. The eyes of a king, and she knew he was right. The murder of her parents had sent Miniver into some sort of supernatural meltdown. She'd wreaked a kind of havoc before the Unseelie King, Avery's brother, had apparently zeroed in on her and whisked her away from the mortal realm. Celine wondered what further damage she would have done if Caliban hadn't come. Miniver had always had so much anger inside. She'd hidden it behind soft tones and shy glances, but she'd sung it between the soulful, beautiful notes of her songs. And Celine was her twin sister. She'd always known. There was an intensity to Miniver that almost no one seemed to have any longer. The world had grown larger and more shallow, like an ocean spreading out over a vast desert, its depths destroyed so it could water the thirsty sand of a fruitless earth. Miniver felt everything. Celine understood this. To some degree, Celine was the same way, and always had been. But with Minnie, it was different. It was painful to an unfair degree. No one should ever have to feel the pain of others to that extent. It was no wonder to Celine that her sister had once tried to kill herself. Eventually, even the strongest of souls deserved to stop suffering. Celine wanted to be with her now, to comfort her and hold her, but Minnie wasn't safe in this world. Or rather, the world wasn't safe right now with her in it. Not now that her wisher powers had been set free. She had to deal with this elsewhere, in some realm where she could only do so much damage before she came to grips with the enormity of this situation. If there was anyone in the many worlds who could keep her safe, it was one of the 13 kings. And if there was any one of the kings who would wish to keep her safe, it would be her destined mate. And there were so many forces out there who would do anything to get their hands on her before she took her place on her throne. No doubt, they were just waiting for Celine to do something foolish, like finally break down and attempt to find Minerva for them. Celine nodded to Avery and pulled her gaze from his. Every time she did that, she could feel the hiccup in Avery's power. He wasn't used to people being able to break eye contact with him when he didn't want them to. He wasn't used to anyone being able to do anything he didn't want them to. And every time she reminded him that she could do just that, it was like a poke in his well-muscled side. It was a reminder that she was the queen in this little chess game, and the queen had all the power on the board.
"I've been meaning to ask you something," she said, changing the subject in yet another attempt to get her mind off her sister.
She concentrated on pulling a chunk of bread from one of the leftover breadsticks at the center of the table.
"How many times are Fae sighted by humans? I mean, you have portals and stuff, and you have for centuries, all those tales of sea monsters and changelings and whatnot. How many are real?"
"Well, first of all, we have portals and stuff," he corrected her softly, smiling around his words. "You're the queen, if you recall. The Seelie realm is just as much yours as it is mine, if not more so." He gave her just a second to let that sink in, and Celine felt herself blush. "As to your question, to be honest, humans see us all the time. Our kind have become exponentially lax in hiding ourselves in the last few decades. We've been filmed and photographed countless times."
"You mean like those films on YouTube?"
She and her sister shared a fascination with the supernatural, with sightings of strange things, with unsolved mysteries. They always had. Now, of course, Celine understood why. Avery nodded, stealing the other end of her breadstick and popping it into his mouth. Clearly, he'd gotten over her little show of power very quickly. In fact, Celine sort of got the feeling that he was not only totally okay with her power, but a little turned on by it. Those purple-flecked green eyes of his were sparkling.
"How many of them are real?"
"It used to be a lot more, probably around 80 to 90% of them," he said, just before waving the waiter over for the check. They'd been finished eating for at least an hour, but the restaurant was a fancy one, and waiters don't like to bother the clientele until the clientele decide it was time. "But human technologies made it possible to create convincing images."
"Tell me about it."
Celine had always had a fascination with the supernatural, and she'd perused more than her fair share of online pics by people who claimed to have captured the real deal. Avery smiled, and his brightly hued eyes flashed secrets.
"People are desperate for something to believe in."
The waiter came, presenting the check. Avery signed a receipt. Apparently he had a card on file. Then he left money on the table, pushed out his chair, and stood. Celine stood with him.
"So now the video market is flooded with a lot more fabricated productions?"
she wagered, following his line of reasoning. He nodded once, placing his hand at her back to lead her out.
"And the number of bona fide sightings has gone down to slightly more than half."
Celine stopped in her tracks on the sidewalk just outside the restaurant's door.
"More than half?"
She turned to face the Fae King.
You mean to tell me more than 50% of what I find on YouTube is factual?
She shook her head.
No way!
She thought of all those video sightings of mermaids and sea monsters and UFOs, hundreds of them, splattered across YouTube, and then compared them to what CGI creators could make happen on the big screen in movies, from Harry Potter to Maleficent. They could do anything. Avery chuckled.
What?
He asked softly. You don't believe in mermaids? Celine blinked.
How did you know I was thinking about mermaids?
You look like a girl who really wants to believe in mermaids.
Celine's gaze narrowed.
All you have to do is read the comments, and you're reminded of how easy it is to fake this stuff. How do you know it's the real thing? You can't be everywhere at once.
Can't we?
His smile broadened, and Celine had that unsettling feeling that the shadows were watching her, and the walls and streets and rocks and trees.
Think about it,
he continued, wrapping his arm around her shoulder to lead her down the street and into the parking garage where they'd left her car. He normally chose to ride a motorcycle, but Celine was rather fond of her Mini, so she'd insisted they be mortals tonight and take it.
What would anyone intelligent do if they needed to keep something like this relatively secret?
He asked. Celine considered that.
There is no way to keep your secrets any longer.
Cell phone cameras were everywhere, and humans had gotten really fast at pressing those buttons. In fact, when anything dangerous or deadly happened any longer, people were more likely to pull out their phones in order to film rather than to call 911.
Nope,
Avery agreed. They reached the top level and Celine fished out her keys.
There isn't. So we do the next best thing. We've enlisted trolls, some of them actual trolls, around the world to leave comments on these sites, making certain human doubt stays right where we need it to. Nice and high.
He stopped at the car and waited for her to unlock it. Then he popped her door open for her, gesturing for her to get inside. His phone beeped, and Celine stepped back as he pulled the cell from his back pocket and glanced down at the screen. Hers beeped a moment later, and a dark feeling moved through Celine. She made eye contact with her mate, and unspoken messages passed between them. She popped open her handbag, pulled out her iPhone, and glanced at the screen. It was a text message from Evelyn D'Angelo, Roman D'Angelo's wife and queen of the Vampire Nation.
"Meeting is being called,"
she mumbled.
"And Lalura and Roman want the queens in attendance as well,"
finished Avery. Celine processed that. There was so much to learn about the other kings and queens who made up the famous and infamous 13. For instance, the aforementioned Time King. Oh, the questions she had. Every once in a while, the reality of what she was and what was expected of her struck her in the face like a flat-handed slap, and she felt stunned, like right now. It would all take some getting used to. But she was a quick study and a strong woman, and the fates knew she'd never, ever back down from a challenge. Avery placed his phone back into his back pocket and looked around. She knew he was taking in how many people were in the parking lot, and whether or not they would be seen stepping through a portal. A lot was on the top level of a multi-tiered parking garage, where few ever chose to park if they could help it, because people were generally lazy and because no one wished to expose their vehicle to the elements if it could be helped. Supernatural beings who could open portals often chose to park at the top levels for exactly such a reason. It provided necessary privacy in the event such a portal would be needed.
"We're all clear,"
Celine said. Avery turned and raised his hand toward an empty space in the lot. The air began to spin, to glow and to separate. When the portal was large enough for them to move through, Avery lowered his arm, grabbed her hand, and the two stepped through. The car behind them beeped twice, its headlights flashing as Celine relocked it just before the portal closed, shutting them off in their journey to another place and time. Chapter 3.
"She's composed of anger," whispered Caliban. "As is proper for a wisher, no?"
came the weathered reply. Cal turned to the man who'd spoken. Thanarive Dramar was a blue-eyed man 4.5 feet tall and as wrinkled as an aged apple. A white beard brushed Dramar's slightly paunchy belly, which he staunchly blamed on his wife's cooking, the only thing in any realm that could pull him from his job, and had on many occasions. But she was an award-winning doo-wom cook, which were unabashedly the best in all the Fey lands, and so Caliban could very much forgive this. The exceedingly old man had been his adviser for thousands of years, but time meant little to a Fey. It was the wisdom in his eyes, the honesty in the depth of his tone, and the fact that this man had actually helped raise him, and had once literally died for him, that touched Caliban's heart in a way little else in the realms could. Doo-wom Fey were inhabitants of the Twixt, that realm between the realms. They were born with two very long lives. Dramar had sacrificed one of his for Caliban, when the Unseelie King was quite young and still more foolhardy than not. Caliban would never forget it, even though Dramar seemed to have done so.
"It's a bit different with her," Cal insisted quietly. "She is not like her sister. She even knew who I was," he said, turning to face his adviser. "And my weaknesses."
"Wishers are powerful Fey, Caliban, with minds of steel,"
said Dramar quietly, his voice as papery with age as Lalura Chantel's.
"They can recall things they have only known fleetingly. It's possible she is simply remembering what little knowledge of the Fey realms she gleaned while in her mother's womb, and while she was an infant in her mother's arms. No doubt her mother told her stories or sang her songs."
"Possibly. However, I don't believe this knowledge was so intrinsic for her sister. Celine didn't know Avery for who he was."
He shook his head. "For Minerva, it was immediate. She's different."
"Not like her sister, eh?"
Drummer asked, rubbing his chin in contemplation. Caliban, like any good Fey king, came by his knowledge of what transpired in the Fey realms through various channels. Elementals were a favorite form of spy, for instance. Air elementals could be anywhere at any time. Water and earth elementals were nearly as easy to call upon. In many situations, even fire elementals were useful. Then there were sprites, spriggans, trolls. A veritable plethora of eyes and ears surrounded the world, and most of them reported to Caliban. But even so, they were not in all places at all times, so Caliban was lacking some information about the new Seelie Queen. He hadn't had a chance to speak with his brother personally in days, and Avery was good at not being spied on. Cal was forced to make approximations.
"From what I've gleaned, both wishers possess surprising power. But beyond their shared empathy and kindness, they seem to be night and day."
The old adviser ran his knobby fingers through his very long white beard and walked a few paces away in contemplation.
"Yes, that makes sense."
Cal's brow furrowed.
"Oh?"
Dramar turned back to face him, and as he always did when he had to look up at his king, he tried to stand up a little straighter in his aged frame.
"Twins among the Fey must divide their strengths and weaknesses, their likes and dislikes, and their light and their darkness. It's only natural that one would possess more of some of them than the other."
He nodded, mostly to himself, and stopped stroking his beard to hobble quickly past Caliban to a window on the other end of the Unseelie throne room. It looked out over a vast and strange land, filled with more wonders than most mortals could ever conceive.
"Yes, I can see them now. I imagine young Celine Tristane is like the full moon. She is visible. She shines bright, and as far as those around her are concerned, she would appear the stronger of the two.
The adviser turned to Caliban, and his blue eyes became steely with knowledge.
But Minerva is the dark side of the moon.
Caliban's chin lifted slightly. He felt a chill move through him, and that was something he hadn't felt in ages.
And we both know which one is truly more powerful, don't we, my boy?
Caliban swallowed, his throat working against the sudden tightness. The moon was more than important to the Fae, both Seelie and Unseelie alike. It was their banner, their symbol, their guide, their eternal token of faith. It rode upon their flags and armor for a reason. The moon was a part of them. The full moon was as Drummar had said. It was visible, comforting and symbolic. But the dark of the moon, the dark side was hidden. It was mysterious. Legend had it that the dark side of the moon was the source of Unseelie magic. Untapped, it was the strongest magic in the Fey realms. Undisciplined, it was the most deadly.
Your queen's magic is darkness, Caliban. She is your darkness, but because of her blood its fuel is anger. She is a wisher, and a wisher's power is in the seeking of vengeance. Injustice is its birthing bed.
The adviser shook his old head, and his expression became weary and disheartened.
Poor soul has never had a choice in how much pain she must feel. The darkness in her feeds off it. It will die without it, and so she has no recourse but to experience all agonies. Hers,
he said softly,
and everyone else's.
Caliban felt odd standing there in the midst of this revelation. He imagined the untold sufferings that took place in the mortal world, and then he imagined how Minerva must have felt suffering them right along with it. Every time a plane crashed, a child was killed, a girl raped, a family left without their homes, or one another in the midst of a tyrant storm. She felt that loss, that indignity and that terror. And beyond humanity, the suffering only continued. From slaughterhouses to hunting. The Shifter King, whose kind had been hunted to veritable extinction, could testify to that. Cal could only imagine that before very long at all, Minerva would have shied heavily away from anything that exposed her to the pain around her. The news would never play on her television. She would never read the paper. She would have to find some way to hide from the gossip, from the headlines, from everything. The very soul of empathy. This was Minerva Tristane. To be able to empathize with your fellow man made it possible to know how to reach them, how to argue both sides, to become an effective casemaker, comforter and friend. Empathy brought good deeds, to be sure, but no good deed goes unpunished, and kindness was a gift and a curse.
"Let me see your wounds,"
Drummer said suddenly, slicing through Caliban's thoughts. He looked up at his adviser's request and met a steadfast, demanding gaze. It took a moment for the request to sink in before Caliban realized what Drummer was talking about. There was little point in voicing his next question, but Caliban had always been the stubborn kind.
"How did you know?"
he asked, as he self-consciously touched his fingers to his chest, where Minerva's attack had left him dearly wounded.
"I know women,"
the adviser replied easily, with a slight shrug of his hunched shoulders. Cal took a deep breath. "Fine," he thought. "So what if the old man knows? Hell, he may know of some way to help me heal." He grasped the hem of his long-sleeved black shirt and lifted it to expose the red, angry markings where iron had made contact with his body. Drummer's brushy white brows raised in keen interest.
"I'm impressed,"
he said, coming closer to get a better look.
"And you're sure you were fully clothed when this happened?"
Caliban knew he was joking, but the jab did little to ease his unspoken, very real fears. Miniver had managed to sear his flesh by hurling objects at